KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akkwan. The Hlone Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once a source of food, a place to maintain smokehouses, and a place to gather driftwood for fuel. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Akkwan. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways, and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. We'd also like to take a moment to say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gnoth Cheesh to Vera Starbird, who planted the idea of making it super place-specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave additional ideas. And Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who gave important feedback. We are so grateful to all of those offering guidance as we grow as an organization. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. When it comes to connecting people with resources, the Juno Community Foundation is kind of a matchmaker and often a problem solver. Here to talk more about that is Amy Skillbred, the Executive Director for the Juno Community Foundation. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Shelley.
And Jamie Waste, Program Director. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Shelley.
Hi, thank you both for being here today. You're both here to talk about some funding opportunities that are currently or soon to be available from your foundation. So let's dive right in. What is first up on your list and who wants to start?
Yeah, this is Amy. I'm going to begin with a couple of grants that we've recently given out. And really, thanks to the community and everyone's generosity, we raised over $320,000 in our COVID-19 community assistance funds. And the last round of grants that we had went out just recently. We released $5,129 for Haines assistance as they faced the challenge of COVID and the natural disaster. And then $10,000 we gave to the Southeast Food Bank operations for food purchases. And the food bank manager indicated that they've seen an increase in the demand for additional food, and they welcome donations from individuals and businesses and have food drives throughout the year to assist with keeping food on the shelves. Then $10,000 went to the weekend food backpack program for students, and $10,000 to the Teen Health Center at the Juno High Schools that support additional counselor time. And the final grant that we gave out was $4,000 to support youth transportation to activities, and that's being distributed by the Zach Gordon Youth Center, helping to get young people back to participating in activities and getting out there.
That's wonderful work. You guys must be really pleased about being able to distribute all that money to such great causes and organizations and individuals. How did folks find out about those grants? How did they connect with you in order to secure those resources?
Well, we've been reaching out to social service organizations ever since the COVID-19 first popped up in March, and we give out about $2 million in social service funds between the Juno Community Foundation's Hope Foundation and the CBJ Social Service Fund. And so between those two and then last year giving out the CARES Act funds for nonprofits, just kept in touch with different organizations throughout the entire, from the emergency to the response and to the recovery stage, which hopefully, knock on wood, we're now entering.
I know these last couple of years, last year and a half. Yeah, they've been unusual. Have you been dealing with larger amounts of grant money than you would normally?
Yes, because we helped with giving out the CARES Act funds, and that was $3 million to all nonprofits in Juno. And then this community fund that came together and folks in Juno donated $320,000 to, that's another chunk of funding that we pushed out the door as well.
And with a pandemic or without a pandemic, folks will still be needing assistance. So I understand you have a few additional opportunities that are coming up that you wanted to talk about on the show today.
Well, I'll jump in here. This is Jamie. So our ability to respond on behalf of the community during the pandemic was we were pleased to see the community kind of trusting in the foundation to send donations and to, you know, assist as we could. Putting the pandemic off to the side, we're very committed to building community endowments that are going to support the community in perpetuity. So in different areas, there's the health and social service area that Amy already talked about. There's arts and culture, there's youth and education, there's parks, trails, and recreation. And in the last couple of years, we've had some visibility there that through the Parks, Trails, and Recreation Fund, we raised funds to build the Hilda Dam Cabin up at Eagle Crest. We secured major funding to complete the renovation of the Treadwell Ditch Trail. We've worked with the Rotary Clubs of Juneau on fixing up the Marriott Trail in the Lemon Creek area. And our most recent grant from the Parks, Trails, and Recreation Fund is actually to Glacier Valley Rotary Club. They're the kind of the community partner with the Riverside Rotary Park. And they've got a master plan, and they're looking to make major improvements, one of which they're completing literally right now. It's the completion of a brand new, much larger, new and improved shelter. It's one of the busiest, heavily most used parks, playgrounds in Juneau. So we were pleased to be able to assist with funding there. It was a $10,000 grant. And it's just an example of what we hope this endowment will do in the future for generations to come, which is be a vehicle for financial assistance to help improve parks and neighborhoods such as this one. Real quickly, Saturday's 9/11, they have the annual memorial service out there. And I think it's the first time that the shelter itself will kind of be publicly, you know, acknowledged as a completed project. So we're pleased to have been able to assist financially. But the most important component here is it's a good project. It's a really good partner, the Rotary Club. And so our ability to help them complete this project was a pleasure on our part. So we hope to do more of this in the future, and with donor support over time, we will be able to do so.
Well, I'm very glad to hear the shelter is going to be open this Saturday. That sounds like it's very timely and meaningful. When it comes to accepting the money from these endowments, from these grants, managing it, distributing it, what is that decision-making process like for you and your staff?
Yeah, we have different funds. We have different decision-making processes. The Juno Hope Endowment and Social Service Funds, we have a couple months, usually beginning about January 1st, where there's letters of interest that we receive, and then there's applications, and then we have a professional advisory committee that reviews both the letters of interest and the applications, and then awards are made by the end of April. And so that's looking at providing funds to specific areas in the social service, homelessness, health, mental health, victims of violence, and suicide prevention, substance use and abuse. And so we're working with folks on that, with nonprofits every day and all throughout the year. And then as new projects come up, and they really present to us what the new projects are and the needs that they see in the community. And then we look to see if we can fund what we were funding and continue to fund more. We also have donor advised funds where the donors select what they would like to do with the funds, and some of them run grant processes. And then I'm going to hand it over to Jamie for the Arts Vibrancy Endowment.
So that would be an example of where donor advisors are helping to make not only raise the money, but turn around and distribute the funds. So just real quickly, the Arts Vibrancy Endowment, that is a source of funding now to support local artists in Juneau. We have the Individual Artists Awards Grant Program, which debuted in 2020. We've had two successful grant rounds to date. Eight different local artists representing different art forms and idioms received grants in the range of $2,000 to $2,500 to help them pursue their dreams, if you will. locally, you know, creating art. We're very excited about this because we're helping to bring additional funding to the arts sector of the community. And one of the local donors who's really keen on this earlier this summer contacted us and offered a matching grant, a challenge grant, dollar match of up to $145,000. And we were really kind of blown away by that. We thought this is a very exciting opportunity to grow this endowment. Very happy to say that we're almost to $145,000. We're just $3,000 short at this point. And this donor put a time limit on it, and the deadline is actually this Friday. So, Shelley, it's very nice that we're on the radio to talk about this right now, because if anybody is interested in contributing to this grant program that's supporting local artists, your donation will be matched right now, dollar for dollar. And you can go online to the website, the foundation website, or put a check in the mail. Either will work.
Yeah, and Jamie, when's the next opening for applying for a grant from the Arts Vibrancy Endowment?
Yeah, it's coming up. It's October 15th. So anybody who's not aware of this, again, go to our website, and it's pretty easy to find the application information about the Individual Artists Award Program. But the deadline is October 15th for the next round of applicants.
And what's the application process like for those who are out there listening and thinking about applying?
We don't think it's very rigorous. I mean, it's comprehensive enough, but I think if somebody took 5 minutes just to go online and read what's required, it's pretty straightforward. If anybody's ever applied for a grant before, it's pretty, you know, what's your budget, what's the project title, description, how's the money going to be used, things like that.
And one of the things that I often do is encourage folks and nonprofits to reach out to us if they have any questions, if they have something that they'd like to see if they can get a grant for, to let us know, and also to talk to us. Like if you're applying for a HOPE CBJ grant, what's the project? And we'd be happy to talk with you about how it fits.
Great. Amy Skilbred, Jamie Wace of Juno Community Foundation, thank you both so much for your time, for talking with me today, for sharing all that great information. Was there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners today?
Just a real quick, it's a required minimum distribution time for many people who are in 70 and a half or 72, depending on their birthday. And just to make a plug that they can give up to $100,000 as a qualified charitable distribution. And we're happy to assist folks in figuring that out if they don't know it. And we have, it's just a way to give to every nonprofit, including K2. So.
All right. Well, thanks for the plug there. Appreciate the time speaking with both of you. And thanks so much for being on the show today. I hope you have a great afternoon.
Thank you, Shelley.
You too. Thank you, Shelley.
I'm Shelley Delaney, and last week I had the opportunity to interview one of the strongest voices in public media right now, Jen White. She's currently starting her second year as host of the NPR show 1A, although you may know her from the podcast Making, where she narrated the origin stories of Oprah Winfrey and Barack Obama, among others. Now she's the one who gets to tell her story and answer the questions instead of asking them. Enjoy. Jen White, host of the NPR show 1A. Would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners here in Southeast Alaska?
Oh, wow. I think you said most of it. I'm Jen White. I host 1A out of WAMU and NPR. I am originally a Detroiter, grew up in Michigan, the Mitten State. I've spent most of my career in the Midwest until this most recent move to D.C.
You started off your public media career in development, fundraising, moved on to an All Things Considered host, and then a podcast, Making, and now you're the host of 1A. What draws you to public radio?
I fell in love with radio as a medium when I was a little girl. My dad had a collection of tapes with old-time radio shows on them, things like The Lone Ranger. And when I was a kid, I would pop these cassette tapes into the player and listen to them. I could listen for hours. And I fell in love with the power of the human voice and the art form of storytelling without images. So yeah, that love affair with radio started when I was a kid. But then when I was about 16 years old, my older sister and I were driving somewhere. I don't remember where we were going, but she said, there's this show you've got to listen to. She was an engineer for one of the auto companies. And she said, I think you'll really like it. It's these two guys. They know everything about cars. They're really smart, but they're hilarious. And she introduced me to Car Talk. And I started my public radio listening when I was about 16 years old. Car Talk was my gateway program. And then my listening expanded from there. So it's been this sort of lifelong journey to working in public radio. So when I got a chance to work at a public radio station, Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was through that development door, I jumped on it because I'd been a fan and a follower for such a big part of my life.
Car Talk was your gateway program. I love that.
It was.
What are some other programs that you like now? What are some NPR shows or other shows or podcasts that you're listening to that you don't miss?
Oh, my gosh. I love Reveal. They do such a great job of investigative journalism. Of course, I tune into Morning Edition and All Things Considered, like a lot of folks who need their little jolt of news as they start their day or as they're wrapping up their commute. I love Wait, Don't Tell Me. I worked in Chicago for a number of years and got to know the team behind that show. And I just think it's really clever and a lot of fun. But I also love shows like Snap Judgment or The Moth Radio Hour, shows that focus on, again, that human voice and storytelling. But I got to say, I listen to a lot. I mean, public radio really shapes my day in so many ways and my weekend. During the week, I'm able to listen a bit less just because of my work schedule. But on the weekend, when I'm, you know, doing the chores, walking the dogs, all of that stuff, that's when I catch up on a lot of my public radio listening. And it just kind of really covers the gamut of what most stations air.
I can relate so hard. Well, you are the voice of 1A on NPR. You're its host. As its host, how would you describe the show?
Well, 1A is a show for people who are relentlessly curious, who want to know about things they're not going to stumble on their own. We cover politics, yes, and we try to do it through a lens that isn't just about what's happening in the Beltway. It isn't just about what's happening in D.C. Because I grew up in the Midwest, I have spent most of my career in the Midwest. I know that a lot of times the news seems to come through this filter of what's happening on the West Coast or what's happening in D.C. or on the East Coast. And there's a whole lot of country in between there. And so we definitely apply that lens to our politics coverage. But again, we talk to a lot of authors. We do a lot of arts and culture coverage. We love science discussions on this show. And fortunately, we have a great team of producers who all have different interests, different passions, and they bring all of that to the program. So the show is just so rich in content. And we also try to center the voices of people who are actually living the stories we're covering. So if we're talking about questions around oil drilling in Alaska, that is a story we've done on the show, we center the voices of people in Alaska who are going to live with the results of those decisions. I will also admit I am a science fiction and fantasy nerd. I love it all. Star Trek is like, it's been a huge part of my life. And so anytime we can get a little Star Trek in the show, I look forward to those conversations personally. But yeah, we just really think about it as this being a place where if you are interested in learning something you didn't know before, listen to 1A. The other big part of the show is listener engagement. We encourage listeners to be a part of the conversation every day by tweeting us questions or comments, leaving messages on our Facebook page, emailing us at 1A@wamu.org. We also encourage people to leave us voicemail messages that we weave into the show, or use our Vox Pop app to leave us radio quality messages that we can also weave into the show. And then sometimes we open the phones. There are moments in the country when it feels like people need a place to just have their say. And this show is the place where they can do that.
1A premiered in January 2017, which is auspicious timing, only a few weeks after the 2016 presidential elections and shortly before, I believe, the inauguration of Donald Trump. Do you know much about how this show came to be, and has the vision changed from its premiere?
So I will say that these decisions precede my time with the show, but the Diane Rehm show, which was also a 2-hour talk show, was, I would say, a staple program of public radio. Lots of stations carried it across the country. And when Diane Rehm decided it was time to step away from the show after decades of service, there was a conversation about, okay, well, what's next? How do we create a space where people can get similar types of content, again, different because you have different hosts and different producers, but really providing a show that stations can turn to kind of try to fill that gap, but maybe also expand a little bit on what Diane's show was doing. And so the show was called 1A, of course, for the First Amendment, because this idea of listeners having a place where they can have their say, that's been part of the DNA from the very beginning of the show. So under its previous host, Joshua Johnson, who I replaced, that was just the ethos of the show from the very beginning. We want people to be a part of every conversation we have. We want listeners to drive the content. And that hasn't changed. That part of it hasn't changed. I think with every host and, you know, with changes in producer teams, you do see slight variations. Of course, there's stylistic differences that come with those changes. But that core tenet of the program, that this show is listener focused, that remains the same.
As you mentioned, you were not the original host of 1A. So when that opportunity came along for you, what was important about becoming the host of 1A, about taking over that position?
Well, at the time I was in Chicago, I was working on another 2-hour show that was local. It was focused on the Chicago region. And I loved that program. It was a show I helped launch. I loved our team. I still do. They're great people. But what I was feeling was this need to convene a national conversation. So much of what I was seeing just in that regional space was people talking, I guess, across each other is the best way to describe it. People talking across each other, and that there weren't many spaces nationally where people could actually talk to one another. And when the 1A job opened up, and someone reached out to me to say, hey, is this something you might be interested in? I had to really think hard about it because I love the Midwest. Again, it's where I grew up. But also feeling like I wanted to engage in this larger conversation that helped people connect to one another. Not necessarily to reach a place of agreement, because I think that's very difficult to do over the course of an hour or 2 hours, but just to have a space where people could have their say. And it was happening in a way that wasn't exploitative, where people weren't yelling at each other, which I think is something public radio was known for, but where we really could hold a mirror up to the nation. And this felt like the place where I could do that. And that's why I decided to move into the role. What's interesting is that I didn't know what was going to happen. When I started the job, this was in June of 2020. My first show actually was July 7th of 2020. It was during the pandemic, but it was before the election. It was before the January 6th insurrection. So much happened just in that first year of me hosting the show. And I didn't know how important it was going to be to have that space, to have a place where people could come for reliable information about the pandemic, about vaccines. We have experts on the show every month just to answer listener questions for a full hour. We open the phones so that people could have a chance to reflect on what happened after the election, during the insurrection. I didn't know how important a space like this was going to be. So while the work itself has been challenging for me and for our team, because we've been dealing with a lot of heavy subjects over the course of the last year, it was the right move to make. I think that mirror for the nation, it's never been more important than it is right now.
And some of those episodes were really incredible.
Thank you. Thank you.
When you started in June and July, squarely in the midst of pandemic lockdown, how was that for you? Were you recording from a home studio this whole time?
No. I've been one of just a handful of people, very few people who have been coming into the station on a daily basis. And so when it's been such a weird transition, Shelley, I'll tell you, because the first year of my time at WAMU, that's where we broadcast, was me, our executive producer at times, Rupert Allman, and my engineer. And we would be the only people in the entire station. I've gotten to know my team largely over Zoom. I've gotten to know them virtually. There's some people even now I still haven't met face to face. We're just getting to a place now where people are starting to schedule coming back to work. But even then, it'll likely be in a hybrid mode for most people. And this is the first time I've worked in this kind of newsroom environment where you're not just sitting next to people and able to, you know, bounce ideas off of each other or talk through a problem in a show or a script really quickly. And so what we've had to do is be really deliberate about reaching out to one another and really create spaces where, as you know, the kind of automatic brainstorming that happens in a newsroom environment when you're all in the same space together, it doesn't happen as easily when people are working virtually. And it's been a little lonely sometimes, I'll say that as well. So it's nice that more people are coming back to the station, as long as we can do it safely, of course. So I'm just really now getting to know some of my colleagues at WAMU more broadly, but really getting a chance to have FaceTime with some of the producers who work on the show.
Well, you really nailed it. I don't think I've really got that until you put it into words, how much I just miss that sort of in-person interaction that you have in a room full of people versus like when you're trying to break into the Zoom conversation.
Right. Like, hand raise. It's tricky, isn't it? It's very tricky. Yeah.
Last week, I was listening to an episode of 1A that I really loved. You were talking to sex workers whose income had been basically cut off by OnlyFans and the way they changed their policy. And I was just, as I was listening to that show and thinking about some of the questions I wanted to ask you, what came to mind is how much of the show is your own? How much of the choice and topics, the questions, how much of that do you get to shape?
What I love about our team is that we really do work as a team. Everything we do is collaborative. When we have pitch meetings, everyone is pitching stories, me included. I'm not just kind of sitting back and only taking, you know, in what other people are saying. I bring my own pitches to the show as well. But because we have this great team of producers who have such varied interests and who they don't have specific beats, but they definitely may have subject matter they're drawn to, we get this rich mix of stories on the show. And things that, you know, I wouldn't think of necessarily, or another producer wouldn't think of necessarily. People have their own body of contacts they can reach into to say, oh, I know the perfect person for this conversation. And so, yeah, it's really a team effort. Everybody pitches, everybody brings their ideas to the table. We vet those ideas as a team and refine them. And, you know, if something isn't quite where it needs to be, it's like, okay, go back to the drawing board, figure out what those one or two key questions are or who the right voices are for this conversation, and then come back and let's see where things stand. But yeah, we all have a hand in shaping the content of the show. And again, listeners also play a huge role in what we talk about on the show.
So on the Making podcast, you had the opportunity to interview Oprah. You had the opportunity to interview President Barack Obama. Where do you go from there? How do you top that? Is there a dream guest that's left for you that you still want to talk to?
You know, it's funny because when I think about the interviews I've done that have been the most impactful, it's not the person with the highest profile. They're often the conversations that get the most attention. But I think a lot about a conversation I had with three mothers in Flint, Michigan. This is during the Flint water crisis, at the height of that crisis, I should say. And just talking to them about what it was like raising children when you couldn't trust that the water coming out of your pipes wasn't going to poison your kids, and providing a space for them to express their anger, their hurt, their worry, the insecurity they felt about the future. That interview still lives with me and is a great reminder every day of the importance of this platform and the role we play in bringing marginalized voices to the center of a conversation. Another conversation that's been really meaningful to me is one I had with my parents. We were doing a show on how to improve outcomes for children living in poverty in Michigan. Again, this is when I was at Michigan Radio. And we got into this thing about bootstrapping. You know, oh, you just got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And really wanted to unpack what that really means and what's at the root of that sentiment. And so I thought, hey, let's talk to people who have a quintessential bootstrapping, I'm using quotes there, bootstrapping story. My parents, who were born, my dad was born in the late 1930s, my mom in the early 1940s, in Georgia and Mississippi respectively. And they were born into a country where they really weren't considered full citizens. And yet were able to build a life, a successful life, homeowners, raised seven kids together. But in the course of that conversation, I learned so much about their journey and about how some of their success had to do with decisions they made. But a lot of their success had to do with institutional and systemic changes that made it possible for them to have new opportunities. And they recognized that. When I asked them, do you think you pulled yourself up by your own bootstraps? They said, absolutely not. These are the things that happened that made it possible for us to move outside of a cycle of poverty that existed in our families. Those are the conversations that stay with me. And it has really planted in me the seed that the most important conversation that I have is the one that I'm having in that moment. I don't have a dream interview anymore. If I just talk to them, my career will be made. It is the conversation I'm having in that moment. And I think I owe that to our guests. I think I owe it to our listeners to treat the conversation in that moment as the most important one I can have. That to me is an enormous part of the service side of the journalism we do every day. Don't look, you know, down the road, don't look beyond. Be completely present in the conversation you're having right now.
I love that, Jen. And that is such good advice for someone like me who does a lot of interviews every week. Not every interview is that, like, it might not necessarily be a pressing topic, but it always is important to stay present, to listen to your guests, to respond. So thanks for saying that. And all jokes aside, I know it's not about the biggest get. It's about what you learn, you know, what you learn from the person that you're talking to. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. My next guests are instrumental in teaching and keeping music flowing through Juno schools, even in a pandemic. Joining us now from Juno Alaska Music Matters, Megan Johnson, Executive Director. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
Yes, and Lori Hagee, Program Director and Glacier Valley Music Teacher. Hello, Lori.
Hi.
You're here to talk about some of the programming activities going on with JAM this year. But first, let's remind our listeners, what is JAM and how would you describe your mission?
Yeah, JAM, Juno Alaska Music Matters, serves students from kindergarten through high school, including students at Auk Bay, Glacier Valley, Riverbend Elementary Schools, as well as Zan Tikihini. And a jam uses the experience of learning an instrument and playing in an ensemble to not only develop fine musicians, but to foster creative outlet, social emotional growth, and academic readiness.
Anything to add to that, Lori?
I would say, in addition to that, the idea that they learn, it's an El Sistema-inspired program where Dr. Abreu would say that the orchestra is a metaphor for an ideal society, that everyone has their own role, but together create something of beauty and of worth that they could never have done alone. And so our goal is through music for all of our students to see that they are contributors to their society, society and community.
And this year marks the 12th season of Juneau Alaska Music Matters, so a happy anniversary. I'm not sure how long either of you have been involved, but how would you say the program has changed since the beginning, or at least for as long as you've known it?
Well, Lori Hagee is the founder of JAM 12 years ago, and she invited me to come on 10 years ago when our original cohort, our original group of kindergartners started second grade. In kinder first grade, our students receive 90 minutes of violin during the school day, and then in second grade, they go to a tuition-free after-school club that includes violin, cello, and all sorts of exploratories, music tech, ukulele, songwriting, dance. And that's one of those things that keeps evolving. We're always on the lookout for local artists who are interested in partnering with JAM and want to teach. And so, I mean, it's really organic. Every year is reflective of the arts in our culture, or in Juneau. With COVID, of course, we saw a shift to virtual learning, which was challenging, but has also opened up some new avenues for us as well. We will be in person this year, but offering some virtual classes for students with health issues and such. But we also last year offered our first family ukulele class in the evening, which turned out to be a big success. And we had grandparents from far away and family members here at home with their students all playing ukulele virtually. And so those are the kinds of things that, you know, we just keep adding to our program. So that virtual component. And then the website just keeps growing and growing with all sorts of free resources. A big part of Sistema is just, you know, that we give freely everything that we have, that access and equity in orchestra and in instruments is open to all. And so that's another area that keeps growing. And Lori, I'm sure you could think of some more too.
Well, this year in particular, JAM is a program about social change and how can we make it a positive impact for our students and community. And this year we are partnering with the Juneau School District, University of Alaska Southeast, Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, and Gold Belt to begin to teach the kindergarten and first grade violin in Tlingit, to help change and reverse the direction of fluent speakers. We're at a point where there's only 40 fluent speakers remaining, and it's our youth that are our hope. And so there's many people, Hune, Lance Twitchell, Kutliek, Robbie Littlefield, Elders, Dasia, and we also have George Holly writing Tlingit music so that our kids are learning the language through music, because Tlingit is a tonal language. It has high tones, low tones, long vowels, short vowels, and we know that music is a way to help you remember things. So why not introduce the language through music and to do it at the 5 and 6 year old, where their mind is ready for language and they actually have a chance to be fluent because we're starting at such an early age. So we're very excited. It's called Hatu Yeyedi. It is inside of us, and it comes from Kingesti
David Katzik, who said it's already within us. And so we're really excited to be working on that this year at Siti Tishanach Glacier Valley.
I agree. I think that is really exciting. I think it's so important that the youngest among us have access to music and access, of course, here in Southeast to the Thlinkit language. So say more about what's important to you about the fact that JAM is tuition free and making music accessible to all who want to learn.
Yeah, I mean, you know, accessibility and equity and diversity in the orchestra. And those are all foundational principles to a Sistema program and core values for JAM. You can see that through instruments. We provide instruments like library books. They're checked out to students' accounts. And we even, when we have extras, we loan them out to students all throughout the community. There is never a registration cutoff date. Because we know, you know, students who might be in two family homes, it takes longer to get a permission slip in. And so, you know, all those little things help us keep music equitable and accessible. We are tuition free. We're very fortunate in that we have a lot of family members, parents who are willing to donate, but we have no scholarship application. It's completely freely given.
And we do that because music has lifelong benefits. And it becomes a privatized opportunity only for those who can afford it. I mean, it's a dollar a minute for a private lesson. And as Megan said, every child deserves access to the benefits that music brings lifelong. I mean, we're even hearing that if you at least play an instrument for at least 2 years, you can stave off Alzheimer's. I mean, that's how the length that learning an instrument can have on the well-being of an individual.
Now, how did each of you get involved in Juneau Alaska Music Matters? I know Megan is a musician herself, and Lori, you're one of the founders. How did it all come together in the beginning, 12 years ago?
Well, I was involved in a fellowship at the New England Conservatory. Dr. Abreu, who won the TED Prize, I don't know if folks are familiar with the TED Talks, but they always honor somebody who has an idea worth spreading. And so I spent a year in Boston and actually went to Venezuela, where we saw these programs in action, showing how music can bring such positive change to a community. And the part of the fellowship was I had to be geographically flexible to go somewhere to start a program. And luckily Juneau and Glacier Valley, which is where it started, said, "We'll make it happen here, Lori." And I'm so proud to be in a community because we're probably in the only one in the United States where we're only accessible by boat or plane, 30,000 people. We don't have a university with a music program here. And yet because of this community and the way in which we work together, we're able to serve, you know, not on COVID times, you know, over 500 children. And that speaks volumes to how this community and the talent here work together to serve and give opportunities for our kids. So I just want to say gracias to Juneau and all of our partners who have helped keep this program going and growing in our 12th year.
Well, Megan and Lori, thank you so much for speaking to me today. I am so happy that I could help share with our listeners all the wonderful work that JAM is doing, Juneau Alaska Music Matters. And as we say goodbye today, we have a clip that you wanted to share with our listeners. Yadu ak gik yayi jayi. Here's my violin. Would you want to set it up for me, please?
Sure. This is sung by Kutsyek Robbie Littlefield. She teaches Tlingit at the university, and they now have a certificate in Tlingit language and in Tlingit teaching. And so she translated this song that we teach in English about the different parts of the violin, but you're going to hear it in Tlingit. And the violin in Tlingit is Gekja.
Gekja. Cool. cool. Well, thank you both very much. I'm going to play that next, but I just wanted to say thanks again for your time, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon, and gunosh cheese.
Gunosh cheese.
Take care.
Thank you.
Yadu ach, ich jayi, yag ye te ach, chas ye di. EADG dog untik a wultin slagau nagati. Yadu zet kat lektai. Seat yadu ach saksias. Yadu tlit ka a uti. Kukasayek is a team.